Hey, good evening, Truth Seekers. Mike Malloy here on the Mike Malloy program. I still want to say Air America or Nova M. Can't do that anymore because that's not what we're doing. Welcome to the show tonight. I forgot to mention this past week, tomorrow night, it's being referred to as Earth Hour. In your own time zone, tomorrow between 8:30 and 9:30 p.m., there's an organization asking people to dim the lights. Here's some of the places that's going to happen. New York's Broadway Theater Signs, Rockefeller Center, Empire State Building in Las Vegas, The Strip, the Opera House in Sydney, Australia, Eiffel Tower and Elysee Palace in Pali, the Acropolis in Athens, National Cathedral in Washington, D.C., Niagara Falls, the Great Pyramids and Sphinx in Egypt, the London Eye, Ferris Wheel, and the Petronas Towers in Kuala Lumpur, Malaysia. If you are not familiar with what this is about, just do a Google on light dimming tomorrow evening. I had an article about it and got lost in the stack. I was watching the news tonight. Believe it or not, I still do that, the network news. I like to see what they're going to highlight in the 22 minutes that the networks have to provide Americans with all the knowledge they could possibly need in order to live a fulfilling life here in the land of the free and the home of the brave. I'm just being a cynical son of a bitch already, right? Oh, don't you hate that? But two of the three that I watch tonight had stories about the developing seriousness of the homeless situation in this country. It is it's getting to the point now where In some areas, it's approaching, I don't want to say depression-era homelessness, because I don't think that would be correct, although I don't know. That term is being bandied about by some homeless advocates for the homeless. But usually the story by, teased and headlined by Charlie Gibson or Brian Williams has to do with tisk, tisk, how could a country such as ours allow this many people to be homeless, especially children? It's a horrifying story, and it's a legitimate question. But, of course, for Brian Williams or Charlie Gibson to be asking the question is beyond ludicrous. They work for organizations that persist in making sure that homelessness continues. Don't forget what capitalism needs. It needs a bottom rung. It needs a lot of people at the bottom of this rung that are desperate for work, will take any kind of work for any kind of wages. And that's part of the meat that the capitalist machine needs to continue to live. I mean, it just is. I'm sorry if I'm sounding like some kind of a socialist or a Soviet-style central planner. That's not my intention. These are just facts. They're facts that we don't talk about in the United States. We've never talked about this. We didn't talk about this in high school economics classes. The best system in the world was the American system, the capitalist system. In fact, it's not, but that's the propaganda that we've all grown up with. So homelessness is coming to the point now, once again, where it's becoming a serious, serious factor in a macro sense. In a micro sense, anybody who's homeless is in just absolute desperate straits. I was talking to some friends the other day about how do children who are homeless, how do they get to go to school? And, of course, the quick answer is, well, you list the homeless shelter as your address. I don't even know anymore. It varies from school district to school district across the country. But it's becoming a serious issue, again, still, perhaps still. And I'm just wondering, after watching these stories, I'm wondering if homelessness is still a joke among the right-wing talk thugs. I can remember back in the late 80s when we entered into another recession because of the Bush One. And this is back in the day when I still used to listen occasionally to the Limbaugh program. And I would hear Rush Limbaugh making all kinds of just not cynical, but violent jokes at the expense of homeless people. He worked for, his studios were in the ABC, broadcast facilities in Manhattan back at that particular time. And he used to talk about how he could look out his window and see people huddled over warm air grates, down on the street, and he just thought that was hysterically funny. It just provided so much fodder for this large, drug-addicted son of a bitch to make all kinds of jokes. And I just wondered, is it still a joke to these right-wing talk thugs? Limbaugh used to refer to them as, what, urban campers or city camper, urban pioneers. Heating grates were a good idea for them because, you know, they were free. But, you know, I just wonder now that so many of those people who spent years having their brains dissolved and turned into water by Limbaugh's lies and distortions, now that they're homeless. And you know that just so many of these so-called Reagan Democrats or the working class that thought Rush Limbaugh represented something that they wanted to come to understand, when in fact what he represented was brain-dissolving acid. And I just wonder, no way to know, of course, but I wonder how many people in these swelling ranks of homeless, people on the street, people who simply can't get jobs anymore, laboring jobs, whether they're carpenters or construction people or even plumbers and electricians, people who used to work in factories making carpet. The carpet industry is more or less centered down here in Georgia, in North Georgia, in Dalton, Georgia. The unemployment rate in that city now is approaching 14%. Now we're getting, that's getting up around depression era unemployment numbers. And I can't help but wonder how many of those poor people who spent all those years laughing along with Rush Limbaugh at stupid feminists, feminine Nazis, stupid poor people, poor because they chose to be poor, I think was what Limbaugh used to say, and one of his clones, the despicable right-wing talk show hosts that are encamped here in Atlanta and have been for a long time, Neil Bortz. Bortz has great sport making fun of homeless people or poor people or people of color. That's why he's so appealing to the white people in the suburbs of Atlanta. I just couldn't help but wonder how many of the homeless people now who used to be Limbaugh fans are realizing that the joke is now on them. The joke was always on somebody else. All the jokes that Limbaugh and the rest of these people made, these right-wing talk show hosts, all the jokes that they made are now on them. And I just wonder, can't help but wonder about that. Two other stories that caught my eye today, both in the print medium and online and also on television, the juxtaposition of the four police officers in Oakland, California, murdered by a crazy man. And the funeral was held today, and the police officers that showed up from all over the country and Canada. There was a contingent of RCMP that showed up to pay tribute to these four officers who were gunned down in the street in Oakland by obviously someone who's out of just totally crazy, berserk, murdered four cops. And the eulogies, they're very moving to listen to some of the eulogies, to watch the reactions of the people in that huge memorial service, and then compare that to the crazy cop in Dallas who demonstrated the inner workings of a man without a heart or a soul, who refused to allow the people to go into there's a couple, I believe he plays football for the Dallas Texans, but at a hospital in the suburban Dallas, and the couple was trying to get into the hospital because the wife's mother was dying, and the cop wouldn't let the man go. The wife, whose mother was dying, and I believe her sister, they ran into the hospital, but the cop just stood there. And if you listen to that audio, you probably saw it today, and you realize, you know, that not all police officers, like not all carpenters, not all talk show hosts, not all college professors, and damn sure not all presidents of the United States, have anything even resembling a heart or a soul. We'll be right back.
Helpless, 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 helpless. You're listening to Resistance Radio with Mike Malloy.
21 past the hour. I guess there's no reason to go through this the story from WFAA in Dallas about the cop who stopped the guy, Ryan Motes, a running back for the Houston Texans. I said Dallas, but I meant the Houston Texans. And his wife and another woman were heading towards Baylor Regional Medical Center in Plano because word came from the hospital to the wife, your mother's dying. If you want to say goodbye, you need to get her. And apparently they went through a red light, and the cop stopped them in the emergency room parking lot. The three people jumped out to go up to be with the dying woman, and the cop draws a service revolver. And the cop yelled to Tamisha Motes, who is Ryan Motes' wife, as she got out of the car, "Get in there. Let me see your hands. Get in there. Put your hands on the car." And Tamisha Motes replied, "Excuse me, my mom is dying." And she and the other woman ignored the cop's commands and rushed inside the hospital to her dying mother. Meanwhile, her husband, Ryan Motes, and this cop went back and forth over insurance paperwork that the NFL player was unable to locate. Motes said, "I've got seconds before she's gone, man. Cop, listen, if I can't verify you have insurance..." Motes, "My mother-in-law is dying." Cop, "Listen to me." Motes, "Right now you're wasting my time." Cop, "If you can't verify you have insurance, I'm going to tow your car. So you either find her, I'm going to tow your car." And as they kept arguing, the officer, the cop got irritated. The cop said, "Shut your mouth, shut your mouth. You can either settle down and cooperate, or I can just take you to jail for running a red light." Jesus, God. And then the tape shows a nurse coming out of the hospital, a nurse pleading with the cop to let this guy join his wife and her dying mother inside. And he still wouldn't do it. It's unbelievable. Twice the hospital sent nurses out to try to get the cop to release Motes, to let him go. The nurse says, you hear this on the police videotape, the nurse says to the cop, "We're blue coating her for the third time," which I guess means it's an arrest code, heart arrest, whatever. And then another cop, a Plano police officer, this guy's from Dallas, I guess, a Plano police officer stopped to make a plea to the other cop to let Motes go. The Plano officer said, "Hey, that's the nurse. She says the mom is dying right now. She wants to know if I can take him, the other cop can take him up there." Finally, after 20 minutes, this goddamn cop and his goddamn parking speeding ticket or red light ticket, can you imagine this? Let's Motes go. And he said, "I went up after she passed and held her hand, but she was already gone." The police chief is calling for an investigation. The Dallas chief, David Kunkel. What makes people do that? What makes a cop do that? I mean, the cop is standing there. The car is parked in the hospital emergency room. These people are desperate to get inside to see the dying mom who is drawing in her last breath. And the cop does that. As I watched that video, I was surprised the cop didn't pull out his gun. Well, he did pull out his service revolver, but I'm surprised he didn't order the woman whose mother was dying that if she moved, he would shoot her. First, he screamed at her to get back in the car. I mean, what kind of mindset is it? Is it just a person who's locked in and can't, just absolutely can't make a decision, can't say, "Look, all right, go ahead, be with your mom. I'll wait outside by your car because I know you can't get away. And when you come out, then we'll talk about insurance. After your mother dies, then we'll talk about your car insurance and your red light ticket, okay?" I mean, even that, even something that humane, that concerned about another human being. Now, I wonder, and I can't help it. I'm white, so I have to wonder if this white cop wasn't playing this kind of vicious, putrid game because the people he was harassing were black. I'm sorry, I can't help it. Can't help it. I wonder if the people jumping out of that car, if it would have been a white man dressed in a coat and a tie and an elegant white woman dressed elegantly and another white woman, and they said, our mother's dying. I wonder if the white cop wouldn't have said, oh, okay, well, go ahead. We'll get to this later. I wonder. Well, I guess that's just the cringing white person inside of me, right? I can't stand stories like that because they are just so, they just demonstrate how devoid of compassion or empathy for another person some of us really are.
He's the primal scream you suppress. Embrace your inner liberal warrior with Mike Malloy.
Twenty-six before the hour. Yeah, I'm reading your emails. I haven't gotten any yet that are very supportive. Well, how can you support what the Dallas cop did? But whoa. No, I hear you. You know, we give people authority and a gun, and God knows for a lot of folks out on the street, it's horrible. I mean, you deal with some of these crazed drug cartel people who have about as much respect for human life as they do for a cockroach, and it puts a whole different equation on it. Or you deal with a hardcore criminal type who just doesn't give a goddamn how many people he kills or wounds or hurts or messes up. Sure. I stand behind a police officer 1,000%. It's when that renegade or rogue cop who decides that his little procedure is more important than somebody saying goodbye to a dying mother. I mean, that to me is just off the chart. Oh, well. I don't know if you've ever been to the website opensecrets.org, but they put all kinds of information up there that members of the House and Senate, Democrats and Republicans, don't want you to know and do their damnedest to keep hidden from you and hidden from me. So I went there today. Somebody suggested that I take a look at the American International Group, AIG, what kind of money they handed out and to whom last year, 08. And it's pretty eye-opening. The total that AIG handed out to politicians was $644,218. Now, in the big scheme of how much they have ripped off the world, $644,000 is nothing. It's zero. It's a minus. It's a blip. It's pocket lint. It doesn't mean anything. Back here in the real world, though, $644,000 to politicians means a hell of a lot. A hell of a lot. What is interesting is how it breaks down. Of the top 20 recipients of AIG slush money, corporate money, which, you know, should no more be in our political system than, I don't know, dead animals or whatever. Corporate money in our political system is what has killed it, and it is deader than a doornail. Of the top 20 recipients of AIG money, 14 of them are Democrats. 14 of them are Democrats. The top five. Now, let's go. Let me see. One, two, three. Let's go with the top six. Top seven. Number seven, Joe Biden, $19,975. Number six, Mitt Romney, $20,850. Number five, Max Baucus, $24,750. Number four, Hillary Clinton, $37,965. Number three, John McCain, $59,499. Number two, Chris Dodd, $103,900. Number one, Barack Obama, $104,332. So of the top 20 recipients of slush money from AIG, corporate money, slime money, money that should not even be in our political system, the top recipient was Senator Barack Obama. And his, our vice president came in at number seven. Also in the top 20, Rudy Giuliani, Dick Durbin, Charles Rangel, Bob Corker, Republican of Tennessee, of course, Jay Rockefeller. He got $6,500. Why didn't Jay Rockefeller just take the check and send it back and just say, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? I spend more than this on waste baskets for my office. Check out my last name, Rockefeller. Here's your $6,500 back. But no, he kept it. But it was kind of shocking to me. Go to opensecrets.org and you can find all kinds of stuff that is shocking, you know, only not really. It's only shocking if you are a almost yellow dog Democrat the way I have been. I've said before that I think I said this the other night. If there's a politician with a D behind his or her name, I just automatically assume, shame on me, that that person has the interests of the country at heart and not the interests of special groups or just there for the power trip or the money or the future lobbying job. And that's a big mistake on my part. I understand that. I hate to come across as naive at this late stage in my life, especially where it concerns politics. But it's difficult to realize sometimes that members of your own party. I just wonder when Republicans are ever going to realize that members of their own party are vile and dark and destructive and don't have their interests at heart. But this list of the top 20 recipients of AIG money was a real eye-opener. And again, 14 of the top 20 are Democrats, and number one, Barack Obama. Oh, I guess I'm not supposed to say that, right? I will piss off Democrats. I'll piss them off. I want you to hear something. Senator Chuck Grassley today, getting nasty on C-SPAN. Chuck Grassley, Republican of Iowa, and Kent Conrad, Democrat of North Dakota, during a Senate budget hearing, I think it was yesterday. And I want you to hear this. The first voice is Republican Chuck Grassley, then Conrad, and then Grassley again.
Remember, you asked me 2 years ago not to take a vote on it. And you said that if we did take a vote on it, you might not get your budget resolution adopted. And so I did not ask for a vote on it. And you said it was a very statesmanlike thing for me to do at that particular time. And so I would hope you would return the favor.
You know, I used to like you. Let me just say... Oh, you are good.
Your wife said the same thing.
Oh, really? Is Charles Grassley, is that a little bit of play in the dozens there? Is Charles Grassley getting down and bonky with Mr. Conrad? Huh? Your wife said the same thing. So did your mama. So did your grandmammy. So did your aunties. And all y'all women folk. Is that what Charles Grassley is doing? Play that again. I've got to hear this again. Can you believe that Charles Grassley is about the whitest white man I have ever seen on television? I mean, if this guy talked more through his nose, you wouldn't be able to understand him. And you know, white folks do that. Listen to this again. This cracks me up.
Remember, you asked me 2 years ago not to take a vote on it. And you said that if we did take a vote on it, you might not get your budget resolution adopted. And so I did not ask for a vote on it.
Right.
And you said it was a very statesmanlike thing for me to do at that particular time. And so I would hope you would return the favor.
You know,
yeah.
I used to like you. Let me just say... Oh, you are good.
Your wife said the same thing.
Ow! Watch out! Watch out, Chuck! Get back! Watch out! Your wife said the same thing. I love to watch white people play. Especially like that. Don't you love that? Man, oh man. I learned how to play the dozens back in school long time ago. And there was this guy in school named Ray Wolford. Rather tall kid in my class who was African American. And we used to play the dozens. And one day in school, this is in sixth grade. We were playing the game, and it was getting more and more intense and sweaty. And, you know, if you've ever played the dozens, you know what I'm talking about. It was getting downright nasty. And this was like in the 50s. And Ray said something that just scored all kinds of points. I could feel the whole classroom collapsing on me. And I thought, uh-huh, all right. So I said, yeah, well, at least my mama ain't black. Oh, whoa, woo, watch out. This is like in 1957, right? When black, nuh-uh. And Ray was about as white as I was, but, you know, he had the one-drop rule, so he was African-American. But when I said that, at least my mom isn't black, next thing I knew, I was down in the desk seat, and Ray had his knee in my chest, and he was just beating the hell out of me. I swear to God. We remained friends. I mean, we went on to high school together, but... Oh, Grassley. Oh, Charles Grassley. That's pretty close to playing the dozens, isn't it? We'll be right back. I'm Mike Malone.
Up America, one flying monkey at a time. It's more Mike Malloy.
Ten before the hour, the other weird piece of audio that we heard today, it was on Overman's program. This representative, Michelle Bachmann from Minnesota, is really losing it. And the really scary part about this woman is she seems rational. She presents a rational appearance. She's not disheveled or, you know, she's not got dirt on her face. Her hair is combed. Her eyes are clear. But, you know, for that matter, so was, you know, Hitler never looked disheveled either. He had great uniforms, didn't he? But Bachmann is out of her mind. This woman is absolutely insane. She was on Sean Hannity's radio program, I think today or yesterday, and she said some things that I think absolutely prove that she's just a lunatic. Now she's calling for, and aren't there laws against this, calling for an orderly revolution? And why? Because of Barack Obama's budget. Now listen to this. This is via a telephone call to a big program, but listen.
We are headed down the lane of economic Marxism as more quickly, Sean, than anyone could have possibly imagined. It's difficult for us to even keep up with it day to day. At this point, the American people, it's like Thomas Jefferson said, a revolution every now and then is a good thing. We are at the point, Sean, of revolution. And by that, what I mean, an orderly revolution, where the people of this country wake up and get up and make a decision that this is not going to happen on their watch. It won't be our children and grandchildren that are in debt. It is we who are in debt. We will be bankrupt in this country inside of 10 years if we don't get a grip, and we can't let the Democrats achieve their ends any longer. Economics works equally in any country.
Really?
Where freedom is tried, the people rejoice. Mm-hmm. But where tyranny is enforced upon the people, as Barack Obama is doing, the people suffer and mourn. And we are seeing the beginning of
tyranny?
That suffering. And if Tim Geithner is successful under President Obama and has a sovereign nation with our own economic system, it's over.
Yeah.
Right now I'm a member of Congress.
Not for long.
I believe that my job here is to be a foreign correspondent reporting from enemy lines.
Oh, my God.
And people need to understand this isn't a game. This isn't just a political talk show that's happening right now.
Oh.
This is our very freedom. And we have 230 years of a continuous link of freedom that every generation has ceded to the next generation. This may be the time when that link breaks, and I'm going to do everything I can, I know you are, to make sure that we keep that link secure. We cannot allow that link to break, because as Reagan said, America is the last great hope of mankind. Where do we go?
The last great hope of man on this earth.
Do we get into an inner tube and float 90 miles to some free country? There is no free country for us to repair to. That's why it's up to us now. The founders gave everything they had to give us this freedom. Now it's up to us to give everything we can to make sure that our kids are free, too. It's that serious. And we can never forget that the founders were rebelling against a governmental authority that abused their taxation power. And that was the tyranny. That's exactly what's happening right now. And we have to rise up and say, no more. Not on my watch. No more.
Wait. I'm not understanding. It was nice to hear Sean's little voice in there. The last great hope of man on this earth was who? Ronald Reagan? Jesus Christ, Sean. Oh, my God. Oh, never mind. Never mind. She says that Barack Obama is enforcing tyranny on the people? Okay. And now we're talking about, I don't know, there's so many crossed lines in what she's saying that should be parallel lines. I mean, the woman is an absolute moonbat. I'm not sure where the taxation without representation is. 95% of Americans are getting a tax cut. And as far as the bailout is concerned, that may be a mistake, but in real world terms, but I don't know. The woman is a lunatic.
My favorite part is when she said, do we get into an inner tube and float 90 miles to some free country? I guess she meant Cuba. Isn't it illegal still in this country to call for armed revolution, or am I wrong?
Well, she modified it a bit when she said, we're at the point, Sean, of revolution, and by that what I mean, an orderly what the hell is an orderly revolution? I'm not sure.
The tyranny of the Obama budget.
Yeah. I mean, we have a sitting United States president who was elected we certainly can disagree with his policies, but as long as he's not tampering, I don't know. Michelle Bachmann needs to be sent someplace where she can have a long rest, get her feet up, have a long rest, maybe let her children or grandchildren, whatever she has, come and visit her and talk quietly to her.
She's a foreign correspondent reporting behind enemy lines.
Behind enemy lines. I don't know. The Republican Party has this wonderful tendency to produce some of the most ridiculous cartoon characters that you can possibly imagine and then give them authority, like Sarah Palin, Joe the non-plumber, Piyush Jindal, let's not forget the Limbaugh, and Bachmann and John Boehner. You can't make these people up. Well, they're great fun. We'll be back after the break. Stay with us. Welcome back. It is 7 past the hour. This is the Malloy program. Email from Ron. Malloy, the interesting thing about that clip you displayed of Michelle Bachmann on Hannity's radio show is, drumroll, most of what she said is true. The thing is, it's true about Republicans. While Bush was in the White House, it reminds me of the saying that when you point fingers, three fingers are pointed back at you. Republicans are like the bank robber who comes out of the front door of the bank hauling the loot. Just as the police pull up in front with the lights flashing, sirens screaming, pouring out of their cars with the guns pointed, and the bank robber points a block and a half down the street, and some fellow just happens to be walking down there and screams to the police, "There he is! Hurry, he's getting away!"
Well, and it's exactly like that Fox and Friends morning thing the other day where they had the actual member of the Columbo crime family on talking about how the Barack Obama administration and Timothy Geithner, it's all a crime family. It's the Obama crime family. And I'm thinking, what?
Yeah.
Bush crime family.
Well, they listen. They must listen to this program.
I call the show Fox and These Friends of Ours.
Yeah, right. Sheila writes about Limbaugh and the homeless problem. Limbaugh, Sheila writes, once went into great detail about how he had to walk two blocks to work and he hated to see the homeless on the streets of Manhattan. He brayed, "But I know how to solve the homeless problem. Just move them over a block so I don't have to see them. There, problem solved. For me, anyway. What difference does it make? They're all hookers and dope addicts anyway. Just get them out of my sight." Well, that was then, and this is now, Pigman, and a lot has happened since then. You've been busted on going after illegal prescription drugs by sending your housekeeper out in the street to score them for you. You went through the cure so that you could garner some sympathy from the judge, and it worked. And you're a lying son of a bitch, but karma is interesting. Because of your drug use, you are now deaf, as well as being stupid as hell. But, eventually, Pigman, something, I just have a feeling in my gut that eventually, because of all the discord and ugliness that you have strewn across the fruited plain, as you put it, that someday something is going to happen to you that is really going to get your attention and make you sit up and take notice of all the stuff that you've done. You know, I just have a feeling. And I'm not talking about some life-after-death event. That's hog's nut. I'm talking about while you're alive, something is going to occur that will make you very alert. I don't know. I just have a feeling. Our good friends, the Turks, who, among other things, are applying for, I don't know why I'm picking on Turks, I guess because of the way they, what's going on in that country right now. Women in that country are being told to commit suicide is the take-home message here. Honor killings, so-called honor killings in Turkey have reached record levels. According to government figures, there are more than 200 a year. Half of all the murders committed in the country. Now, there's a sinister new twist to all this. The emergence of honor suicides. You've heard of honor killings. A lot of societies have them. I hate to see the word honor linked that way, but what are you going to do? It's their term, translated into English. In India, it's my understanding that in certain levels of that society, if the dowry isn't good enough, the new bride is supposed to burn herself alive. In other societies, if things don't work right, the husband tosses acid into the face of his wife, on and on and on and on. But the honor suicides now. Women are being told, you have dishonored your family, please kill yourself. Please kill yourself. According to the Independent of the UK, the growing phenomenon has been linked to reforms in Turkey's penal code in 2005 that introduced mandatory life sentences for honor killings, whereas in the past, killers could receive a reduced sentence claiming provocation. So soon after the law was passed, the number of female suicides started to rocket. This is like in Texas. I don't know if it's still on the books in Texas, but coming home and finding your wife, I don't think this worked in a reverse situation, but a husband who found his wife in a sexual situation with another man had the perfect right to kill them both. That was not a right, but that was a defense. Well, Your Honor, and judge and jury, I caught them together in bed, so I killed them. And how many cases of men in Texas were found not guilty because of that defense? So it's not just Turkey. But soon after that law was passed that said honor killings could give, and it was only changed 4 years ago, that honor killings could result in long prison terms for the men who committed the honor killings. Usually the fathers who had killed their own daughters. Now, the fathers say to the daughters, kill yourself, you brought dishonor onto the family. A woman's fate is usually decided during what's called a family council when the extended family meets to discuss breaches of honor. In these meetings, it is agreed how the victim must be killed. If it's not to be a forced suicide, a killer is chosen. The youngest member of the family is often ordered to kill in the belief that they will be treated more leniently if caught. Now, the Independent of the UK cites a 17-year-old young man, Mehmet, was 17 when he was handed a gun and told he would have to kill his stepmother and her lover. Mehmet said, I didn't want to do it. I was so young and so scared, so he ran away. But his family tracked him down and warned him his own life would be in danger if he refused to kill his stepmother and her lover. He shot dead his stepmother's lover, but his stepmother survived. He was given 2.5-year prison sentence. I don't know. This, when I saw this, it once again brought into focus for me the plight of women in so many societies and of course here too, here in the United States too. It's not just a matter of earning 70 cents or 78 cents or 82 cents for every dollar a male earns, but the crimes of violence against women, it's astonishing. But in so many societies, usually religion based Christian societies, look at the the hardcore Mormons. Remember all the women? When was it, about a year ago? All the women in the prairie dresses that were paraded back and forth on television because their children were taken away from them because of claims of child abuse. The men, the husbands, the fathers who apparently were boinking anyone they could get their hands on inside this closed society. And the authorities stepped in. It was horrible, these kids being pulled away from their mothers. And then I guess they were finally reunited. But in so many societies where a woman's life is as useless as, I don't know, just totally useless. It has no meaning. She is there to reproduce, and she better reproduce boys for the man. It's so true in Hindu societies, Hindu fundamentalists, Muslim fundamentalists. I don't think it's true any longer in Jewish fundamental, Orthodox Jewish families. And Christian fundamentalists in this country anyway are with the, you know, their, secular law prevents them from murdering. Although I'm sure there are a lot of, fundamentalist Christians in this country, males who would like to commit murder against their women for not, performing, properly according to the, revealed word of God. You know how that goes, right? It's just madness, that's all. Just madness that kind of caught my eye. Stick around. I'm Mike Malloy.
Outrage. Oh, here it is. Back to Mike Malloy.
It's 21 past the hour, and we don't have to go too far afield to discover violence against women in this country. Matter of fact, a couple of months ago, I think towards the end of 2008, there was a government report, U.S. government report released showing huge increases in the incidence of domestic violence and rape and sexual assault over a two-year period. According to Human Rights Watch, the statistics compiled in this report showed a 42% increase in reported domestic violence and a 25% increase in the reported incidence of rape and sexual assault. Now, granted, one never knows in those kinds of reports if it just means, or those kinds of stats, if it just means more people are coming forward, more women are coming forward and reporting this, or if the actual numbers of assaults and attacks and beatings and rape and violence is going up. Either way, though, it's a horrific situation. The National Crime Victimization Survey is the name of it. It was based on projections from a national sample survey that said at least a quarter of a million individuals were raped or sexually assaulted in 2007. That's up from 190,000 in 2005, the last year the survey was conducted. And it goes on. Now, I think most of us are well aware, or we should be, that in when times start to get tight economically, violence, family violence, increases almost geometrically. It's a horrifying reality, but it is this is another thing that capitalism does. I've said many times on this program that it is the most family unfriendly economic system ever devised, because capitalism demands unemployment at a certain level. There always has to be a pool of workers at the bottom, a huge pool of workers at the bottom or near the bottom, who are either underemployed or unemployed, period, so that the corporate masters, I hate to use jargon, but I don't know what else to call them, so the corporate masters can always dip into this pool, because don't forget, labor is seen as a cost, not as something that laborers are not to be benefited, they're not to be considered human, they're a cost. And as long as you keep the costs low, you're doing great as a capitalist. So the families that have to experience this, and I'm not just talking about poor families, oh, hell no, all the way up into the middle class and beyond. I think once you get beyond a certain socioeconomic level, though, I think that violence against women is because the men involved are prone to violence. They're sociopaths or psychopaths, and this is a way that they express their manhood. But when you get to a level where all of a sudden the stress inside the family gets to the point where it's going to explode, when it does explode, it's usually the male who starts being violent against the wife and the children. And as we get into this deeper and deeper and deeper into this economic morass that the Republicans have put us into, you know, the family values crowd, you sons of bitches. As we get deeper into this, look for these stats to go even higher. It's horrifying, horrifying. To be a kid and to be part of a family where you have to witness that kind of violence. And I know because it was rampant in my family when I was a kid growing up. I've said before, I spent 13 years in therapy. That's why. So if you're a kid and you see this violence, it's impossible to deal with. I left home when I was 16, and one of the reasons I left home was because I was trying to devise ways to murder my father and make it look like an accident. And even at 16, I realized, this is sick. You've got to get out of here. And it wasn't sexual violence. It was just physical violence, emotional, psychological, physical. It was really, really, really bad. So, you know, been there, done that, had it done to me. And years later, many years later, decades later, when my dad was dying of Alzheimer's, or he had Alzheimer's. He was either Alzheimer's or had become completely schizophrenic. I never could tell. But I think he had serious Alzheimer's. I hadn't been around him for years, but I went to visit him. And I decided I was going to have to try to confront this just once, and I did. And we were sitting on a front porch at his house. This is about 6 months before he died. And I said, hey, I need to ask you something. And he said, what? I said, you know, when I was a kid growing up, and I mentioned my brothers and sister, I said, you so many times you were just out of control. Why? And he looked at me and he said, what? What are you talking about? I said, the violence, the beatings, the craziness that you put us all through. Whoa, I don't know what you're talking about. So I think it was the Alzheimer's at that point. I don't know. But, you know, having experienced that, having grown up with that, I my heart bleeds when I pick up the paper and read about kids who are so frightened and so terrified of a violent parent, usually the father. It's hard to deal with. We'll be right back. I'm Mike Malloy.
Nice guy. Here's Mike Malloy.
It's about 25 before the hour. We are going to open up the lines here at the Molloy program now. If you would like to call in, the number is 877-996-2556 or 877-99-MOLLOY. I didn't mean to freak anybody out there with that little tale of, personal experience of child abuse and violence inside my family growing up. I usually don't get into that stuff about my personal life except with a therapist. But I think there's a lot of kids out there who deal with this, a lot of women who deal with this, who don't know what to do and just put up with it. There's even a name for it, battered wife syndrome, which always kind of gave me the willies. But that kind of violence is absolutely inexcusable, and it does not have to be tolerated. I spent a period of time about 35 years ago working for an organization in southeastern Pennsylvania called Contact. It was a crisis intervention hotline organization. And, I had about 50 or 60 hours worth of training, and then they put us on telephones to handle the calls from people who, and mostly women and kids, who are desperate because of the violence. And southeastern Pennsylvania has a history of it because of their just the cultural makeup, the so-called Pennsylvania Dutch. I'm not talking about the Amish. And and that's a fact. I'm not busting up on that particular group of people, but it is a fact. Some of the stories that we would hear, we weren't supposed to be counselors. We were supposed to be referral people. But you couldn't not listen and try to talk with the people who called in with these stories of absolute horror. And if you've been through that, you know what I'm talking about. Hopefully anyone who's been through that kind of domestic violence has figured out a way to heal, a way to get past it, a way to recognize that the perpetrator was literally sick in the head, and not necessarily evil, but just sick, just mentally disturbed, in order to do that. In this society, in this culture, there are cultures around the world, excuse me, that violence, inter-family violence like that is just culturally accepted. It's just part of the complete, total domination / subjugation of women. But in this culture, that's not applicable. That's not the way it's supposed to be. So, just as an aside, I would hope, and I used to focus on this a little bit years and years and years ago in talk radio. But anyone who's experiencing that kind of violence, if you feel that you have no choice, that's just not true. You do have choices. I realize that's almost impossible to understand when you're right in the middle of it, when you're a victim of it. But there are choices. There are ways to get out of it. It's extremely dangerous. It's a horrible situation. I think anyone knows that the most dangerous time for a woman who's trying to get out of a violent relationship is literally when she is trying to leave. It's at that point that the male will go berserk. Restraining orders be damned. If the boyfriend, the ex-husband, whatever, gets a gun and starts stalking, you see this all the time. You see it all the time. It's especially true here in the South. Sorry, but it's true. Don't get weird on me and say, "Well, I speak on the South." I live here. I know what's going on down here. But violence has always been part of the Southern experience is mom and apple pie. It just is. It just always has been. Domestic violence is always, you look at any statistic and you'll see that most cases of domestic violence, and I use the word advisedly, most cases of domestic violence occur in the so-called Bible Belt. That's part of the religious heritage here. Beat them, spare the rod, spoil the child, that kind of nonsense. You know, if your wife gets out of control, beat the hell out of her. If your children get out of control, beat the hell out of her. How many women are in prison because they took one beating too many and then shot the son of a bitch? I used to worry about that as a kid. I used to be afraid my mother was going to pick up a butcher knife and put an end to the old man. But it didn't happen. She finally left. And then one by one, we kids left. So I'm not trying to freak anybody out with that kind of personal insight, you know, into what I experienced. But I'm just saying, if you are involved, you are in that kind of domestic situation, you don't have to be there. It's a bitch trying to pull yourself away, because even the violence becomes familiar, and almost feels right. So it's a tough situation, and I would never advise anyone to go to their priest or their minister for advice on this. Go to a clinician. You go to a priest or a religious person, you might get the advice that says, well, now, it can't be that bad. So if you are in that situation, I'm sorry to get way off on this tangent, really, but if you are in that situation, you can get out of it. You can. It is difficult to get out of it, but you can get out of it. If you can tolerate it, then I guess you'll stay where you are. But and especially to young kids, let me just say to any teenager that are listening, if you have a parent, that's usually the male, let's be real here, if you have a parent who is being violent to you, psychological or physical violence, you can leave. You can get out. So it's, you know, it's your call. Okay, let's get away from that. Obama unveils his war plan to defeat Al-Qaeda. He did. He announced a new strategy today to, his words, disrupt, dismantle, and defeat Al-Qaeda in safe havens where they nest in Afghanistan and Pakistan. And he's going to do that. He's going to deploy an extra 4,000 military trainers. That's in addition to the 17,000 troops already promised by President Obama. He's also going to send hundreds more civilians and development workers into Afghanistan. I don't know. I my feeling about Afghanistan is to just get out. Just leave it alone. Afghanistan is the place where empires go to die. I don't know what Barack Obama is doing. I really don't. It's just crazy. It's crazy. The Taliban has made a very significant comeback in the last 2 years. They've taken over village after village. Frankly, as far as I'm concerned, these Taliban leaders, I wouldn't be that disturbed if they were lined up and executed. The violence that they perpetrate against children, against women, against each other, you know, violence begets violence. I'm all for it. You know, let's get it on. But I feel that way about all religious extremists. As far as I'm concerned, they're very sick people. I realize it's their culture. It's none of my damn business. But, you know, like John Donne said, you know, I'm a part of mankind, a piece of the main, a part of the whole. Every person's death diminishes me, and so on and so forth. And I think that holds true with violence. When I see that kind of violence, the Taliban blowing up schools while the female kids, while the little girl kids are in there, because these sick sons of bitches don't want their girl folk to be educated. You know, I mean, to me, that's an outrage. So I understand Obama wanting to upend that system. The excuse, that's probably not the word I should use, but the rationale is that Al-Qaeda apparently is now planning new attacks against the U.S., against our allies, against our forces in Afghanistan, yada, 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 yada. Okay. I somebody sent me an email today that said, you know, Obama is not, you can't believe, Mike, that he is the same as George W. Bush. You can't believe that he is, you know, that he has some ulterior motive for some of his foreign policy initiatives. You know, I don't know anymore. I don't know. I don't know from anything. I said it the other day. I have no idea anymore. I have seen Obama do some things since he came into office that are disturbing to me. That that I you know, have a hard time understanding, processing, and saying, okay, that's what has to be done. But, you know, the template against which I measure him is George W. Bush. And if he does, if Barack Obama does anything that has even the faintest outline of the stuff that Bush and Cheney and the Bush crime family did, you know, I'd pull back real quick, like, oh boy, we're being betrayed. But, you know, I don't know. Maybe, maybe what Obama is doing is makes some kind of sense to somebody. It doesn't to me. Of course, I'm open to hear where the sense lies. All right. We'll be back and take your phone calls. Stay with us. I'm Mike Malloy.
Right here, right now, Mike Malloy.
10 before the hour to your phone calls. Frank is calling from Seminole, Florida, listening on the Sirius satellite radio. Hey, Frank.
Hi.
Hey.
This is yesterday's topic about the coal industry.
Right.
And a couple of personal observances, and I'll try to be as concise as I can. In the early 70s, I went to, used to go to Kentucky with my kids and my wife to visit with her relatives. And one of those trips on the way down there, she was reading a book titled Stinking Creek.
Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Oh, okay. There's an exit on I-75 going up there that's the Stinking Creek exit.
Right, in that general area. But she inspired me, and I got reading that book the day we got down there, and I mean, I read right through it. Basically, it was about the coal industry down there. Very little tax money going into the state,
right.
Money being distributed out to key people, and it was basically a ripoff. Money and resources going out of Kentucky, and very little being left there. But my sister-in-law heard us talking about it, so she was our tour guide, led me up the most treacherous drive I've ever had with my carload of kids and family. We got up to the top of this mountain, and something like about a third of a mile across was another mountain, you know, Appalachian
right,
type
right.
mountain.
Mm-hmm.
And there was so much of that mountain that bulldozed down into the valley.
Yeah.
And trees were laying down there. I couldn't, you know, they looked like bonsai trees from where I was at, but they were fully matured, 50, 60 foot high trees, probably. Mm-hmm. And the devastation, you know, and then, oh, we went back down and she took us over by a railroad siding. It must have been on a Sunday, but there were the longest string of coal cars, waiting to be loaded, mounds of coal, end loaders. I figure those, whoever was doing that work was getting minimum wage. So to update it, and I'm going to get real quick and get this done with, but I retired years ago, but for 30 years I was a railroad brakeman, and I worked out of Detroit mainly and Toledo quite a bit.
Oh.
And you're familiar with that Detroit Edison power plant?
Oh, yeah, the up near Monroe, Michigan.
Right. We used to bring cars in and out of there. There'd be cars waiting down in Toledo. You know, it was an assembly line from the coal fields. We would bring in mile-long trains and leave them, and then some gadget they had, they'd pull those things into the plant, and I don't know if they had six, five cars or something. They had swivel joints. They'd turn them upside down and dump them in, and there'd be another train waiting, just endless, to feed that whole megalopolis of Detroit and Toledo. But I used to look at it, and I think it's a hungry mouth. And so I'm in between. I'm trying to conclude this thing. I'm in between you know, the greening of America and all that, and the fact that the demand to have that electricity,
right,
so we can have our toys and gadgets and things. Where I'm at with it, or whatever conclusion I'm trying to get to, and then I'm going to get off this line. But, you know, I want America to be non-polluted, or the world to be unpolluted,
mm-hmm,
and clear, and everybody to get a fair, you know, tax money and wages.
Sure.
But on the other hand, and I think I'm just part of the public, I want my electricity when I want it for all my gadgets, all the convenience. I don't know. I'm going to wrap it up, but I
well, you know. That's Frank. Listen, thanks. I hear what you're saying, loud and clear, and I appreciate you checking in. Okay.
Okay.
All right, sir. Take care. We are a product of or a victim of our culture, our society. We're overindulged. Sure, of course we are. And I think that's what Frank was saying. By the same token, we've come to expect certain things. Either we're going to have to modify those expectations or figure out a way, and there are ways, to produce energy that doesn't do to the environment exactly what Frank's talking about. I've seen those scenes too in Appalachia, mountaintops blown off with trees, and it looks like that area in Russia, Tunguska. I'm drawing a blank right now, but where the apparently a meteorite came down. When was it? In the 20s, 30s, and those pictures that you've seen of fully mature trees, just miles of them laid over on the side, and. Yeah, I've seen that too, Frank, and it's a horror, just a devastating, it just breaks your heart, because it connects, it did with me anyway, into that part of me that is still kind of primeval, that's still the druid inside all of us, you know, that recognizes that as death and destruction, that kind of devastation. So I hear you. I think there's ways to provide the kind of energy that we need. And I'm not saying we need all the things that we need by any means. We've convinced ourselves we do. I think the next generation coming up, or the one behind that, or the one behind that, is going to realize that it just can't go on like this. But there's ways to produce energy, I honestly believe, that we just, for some reason, haven't decided to develop yet. Non-polluting forms of energy. Of course, there's an exchange. The laws of physics demand that in the production of energy, there's going to be some sort of byproduct or after effect or heat produced or something. As far as I know, nobody's come up, even in theory, with energy production that doesn't have side effects that we would just as soon avoid or not have to deal with. But I get you, Frank, loud and clear. And anybody who really wants to see a movie about struggle of miners against the coal companies, just go get it. You can probably download it now. Harlan County, USA. We'll be back after the break. I'm Mike Malloy. Welcome back. 6 and a half past the hour. This is the Malloy Program. Prairie 2 writes fun facts here about electricity use, having to do with our last caller. Prairie 2 writes, more than half of the electricity generated is lost to line resistance before it gets to the meter. Half the electricity we use could be generated by waste heat from industry. Do the math. Oh, and don't let the coal company hear you. Yeah, we have all, you know, we're still using a 19th century model to supply our energy needs. And the 19th century model was, it's an endless supply of everything. The seas will never stop giving us whale oil or fish or whatever. The ground will never stop giving us coal. The atmosphere will never stop cleansing itself. The oceans will never stop circulating the garbage away from us. You know, that idea of endless resources, endless ways to exploit the earth, because, you know, it was in the Bible, right? Uh-huh. And now we're starting to realize that we have lived the entirety of human history has been just an endless loop. And what we do comes right back, and it's coming back now in a way that is questionable whether or not we're going to be able to handle it. I hope so. I hope the younger generation or two that's out there now will be able to look at this and realize that that we have been awfully stupid as a species for the past 150 years. And because I don't blame all this on the baby boomers. I really don't. I mean, the boomers have been on a certain trajectory that was started long before that they, as a cohort, were ever born. So, you know, to blame it on the boomers is nonsense. It's a 150 or 200-year-old process that has now reached that endpoint where if we don't do anything, if we do nothing, and that's one option, is to do nothing, we'll kind of probably rock along here for another 75 or 80 years, and then it's pretty much going to come to an end. Oh, and don't pay any attention to that 2012 Mayan calendar, here comes a huge behemoth planet from beyond Pluto nonsense. Come on, don't. I'm serious. Don't go there. We've got problems right here. So I'm hoping that we certainly have the minds to figure out the technology, and I think we're so close. I think the human species is so close. That will pull back at the last minute. It reminds me of my football coach told my mother after I left home and was living by myself, and my mom was very worried, and my coach told her one time when she went over to say, you know, I'm worried about Mike because I was living by myself, and the coach said, Sylvia, don't worry about it. I know your son. I coach him in football, and Mike gets right up the edge, and then he pulls back. He'll be okay. And I think, you know, I've kind of extrapolated my own experience out, and I think that the human species is going to do the same thing. We may get right up to the edge, but we're going to pull back. I have to believe that. I have to believe that. And I do believe it. So, yeah, there's a lot of doomsaying going on right now, and I certainly contribute to that pool of muck, but I think that within the next 50 or 60 years, and a lot of us listening to this program, certainly me, but won't be around to see this this pullout, this pullback. But I have an awful lot of faith and hope in young minds and in technology. I think technology is going to it's that famous two-edged sword. You know, come here, come here, come here, go away, go away, go away. Technology, the power is there to destroy us or to save us, and I believe that, and yes, it has to do with how the technology is operated. Right. The human factor has to be in there, but anyway, where were we? Oh yes, we are we're doing phone calls here. Leanne is calling from San Diego, listening online. Hey, Leanne.
How are you?
I'm great. How you doing?
Pretty good. You know, I called to talk about the war being extended to Afghanistan. And, you know, my take on President Obama is this. I think he's a pretty weak leader. And you know why I say that?
I'm not sure, but go ahead.
One, he isn't willing to take on the military-industrial complex. Two, he's not willing to take on Wall Street. And three, he's lied to all of us. So I don't think he's going to get elected again. I know a lot of progressive Democrats that have pretty much had it with him. And I think he's a fraud. And I'm sorry that you all, you know, fell for his, you know, his nice talk. I know he talks a good game, but when it comes to deliver, he doesn't.
Well, is do you think he might be rushing it? It's three months.
All you had to do is look at his voting record before.
Right.
And it was there. It was plain to see. I don't know why there were so many Democrats that kept thinking this yes, we can stuff, and you thought that he was going to change, hold his feet to the fire. He's not. And I think the sooner everyone stops deluding themselves, we'd be better off. So maybe next time around, we can vote for someone like Kucinich, who would really, and I think that man has done, look at what he's gone up against. I mean, that man has gone against all the Democrats. And he does what he says. So
I hear what you're saying. I certainly share the frustration, but like I said, I'm not willing to make that kind of a sweeping global assessment on this guy yet. I'm not. I don't know if I mean, I wonder sometimes what his critics, and I'm one of them, what the critics expected him to do. He hit the ground running as hard as he could. He's trying to overcome literally 25 years of a slide into corporatism and close to fascism. What can he do? I mean, we have to go back to 1980 to the election of Ronald Reagan. We've got all the Reagan years, all the Bush 1 years, all the Clinton years, all the Bush 2 years, and this guy steps out and says, okay, we can change this stuff. I mean,
He says it, but he doesn't do it. Where the difference is, Kucinich says it, and he does it.
Well, now, wait, what could Kucinich do right now? I mean, honest, let's talk about this. What could Kucinich do right now that Barack Obama isn't?
Well, for one, he brought articles of impeachment against Bush and Cheney.
Well, but now, wait, we're talking about President Kucinich. A president doesn't enter articles of impeachment. It has to come from the House judiciary.
Okay,
so what could President Kucinich do?
Well, he would not extend the war to Afghanistan, I can tell you that for sure. He would not. And he would take on the military-industrial complex, number two. And Barack Obama does not want to do that because he knows if he does, he won't last very long.
What do you think Kucinich would do when you say he wouldn't extend the war? The war has been going on longer in Afghanistan than it has in Iraq.
He would slowly end it. He would not escalate because this is an escalation of the war.
Well, I don't disagree with you. I don't disagree with you on that point. What about domestic stuff? Are you saying that Obama is a failure because of the Afghanistan situation? What else?
I'm talking about. I called for Afghanistan, but I'm disappointed about the other things also. The two men that he put in there, Geithner and Summers, come right out of Wall Street. So there's a lot of things, and I don't understand why people did not look into his record more before they voted for him.
I think people who looked into his record and looked into his competition's record and then looked into the Republican record came to a conclusion, whether conscious or unconscious, that if this is the field of candidates that we have, then the best choice, given that this is the field of candidates, would be Barack Obama.
Okay, did you ever hear, there's a famous author that wrote the book, I don't know what the book is, he said it's better to have voted for the wrong guy and be right in the end than vote for both guys that are the wrong guys to vote for.
Well, I understand. And listen, Leanne, thanks. I appreciate everything you had to say. Thank you so much. We got a break here. I don't know when that was written, but it might have been written at a time when solutions came much more simply than they do now. I'm not defending Barack Obama. It's just that I'm not ready yet to make that kind of a general statement. We'll be right back. I'm Mike Malloy.
ready for a liberal helping of truth? It's More Mike Malloy.
Past the hour. Yeah, I can, you know, I can certainly understand our last caller, Leanne's disappointment, and she may be right. Kathy in Green Bay writes, it's not that we had so much faith that Obama would change things, it's that we were sure McCain wouldn't. And Kathy also writes, Kucinich wouldn't hesitate to sic the attorney general on the Bush crime family, and I suspect that he'd be much more likely to try to extend Medicare to everyone for those who haven't any insurance. Yes, Dennis would be better. Too bad there was never a chance he was going to win. You know, I had a couple of people that try to convince me prior to this last election that voting for Barack Obama was voting for more of the same, and I disagree with that. There may be some fundamental similarities, and yeah, I'm between Democrats and Republicans. There are. I mean, they're both corrupt. Both parties are corrupt, and apparently we've gotten to the point in this country where which corrupt party do you want? I mean, one leans toward kind of chaos. The other one leads toward totalitarianism. Which one do you want? And I realize there should be third and fourth and fifth choices. And I realize that you and I should start the ball rolling for the choices. Yeah, okay, as soon as I find time to do that, I'll start a new political party. How about you? I'm not going to vote for Ralph Nader because Ralph Nader is ancient. Kucinich, he was in the running. The American people said no, they didn't want him. He was the guy I backed from the very beginning. I made that very clear. We had him on the air a couple times. Remember, Kathy? You know, so, as the American people in our gross monumental ignorance, reduced the field down to two, Kucinich was one of the first to go. Would he have done things differently? We assume from his rhetoric that he would have. But if Barack Obama's rhetoric was garbage, then why, part of it, why do we assume that Dennis Kucinich's rhetoric would not also be partly garbage? I don't know. I don't know. Had Kucinich been elected, won the election, do you think he would have lived to see his inauguration? I don't know. Who knows? Who knows what's going on anymore? It is easy. I'm not talking about Leanne. It's easy to make the statement, and I've made it, that you know, both parties are corrupt. Both parties, it's all the same. It's just a matter of slight degrees. And there is a tremendous element of truth to that, just like when we started the program tonight. I shared with you the 20 top recipients in the U.S. House and Senate of AIG money, 16 or 14 of the top 20 were Democrats. And the number one recipient of money from AIG was Barack Obama when he was a senator, $106,000. Okay. All right. I can come back and say if our political system is so corrupted by money, then what is someone who wants to be elected, what is he or she going to do? Dennis Kucinich said he would take, didn't he say he would take no PAC money, no corporate money? Okay. How long did he last? I don't know what to do. Obama didn't take corporate money, did he? He took money as a senator. But wasn't Obama's fundraising handled over the internet? Wasn't it all $5, $10, $20, and $50 contributions? If Barack Obama in 90 days, less than 90, 80 days, has not shown us that he is the leader we all thought he was going to be, it's been 60 or 70 days, and he has yet to walk on water. He has yet to turn water into wine. In other words, he has yet to prove that he is, in fact, the Messiah. He is, in fact, Jesus H. Christ or whatever name you want to apply to him. He hasn't shown us that yet. So maybe it is time that we say, crucify the son of a bitch. He's a false Messiah. You want to do that? You want to give him more time? I don't like this, you know, as far as Timothy Geithner and Larry Summers. Okay, bad guys, the parade of bankers into the White House today. Bring the thieves into the White House. Bring the scum suckers. And, you know, would I like to see capitalism deep sixed? Yes, because it's a corrupt, filthy, degenerate system that it can no longer apply. Okay. So what do you want to do? Would Dennis Kucinich do that? Would any of the people, would Ron Paul have done it? Would any of the people who were not Obama, who were not McCain, have done that? I don't know. I think sometimes that we look to these individuals as saviors, whether it's Barack Obama or Hillary Clinton or Dennis Kucinich, they're going to save us. And that's not going to happen. It's not. I mean, the last time that happened, it was George Washington, I think. So it's not going to happen. So what's the alternative? I don't know. I have no idea.
Country and his king, of his honor and his glory, the people would sing. Ooh, what a lucky man he was.
Life's too short to listen to right-wing radio. Here's Mike Malone.
Yeah, we're getting way behind here. Let me just, we're coming back to phone calls in just a second. Email from Barry about the Faustian bargain we've made with coal. Barry writes, Mike, the Brits learned the hard way about coal in 1952. And he's referring to the Great Smog of 52, which is considered to have caused or advanced the death of 12,000 Londoners and made 100,000 people ill. More recently, the TVA just paid $9.5 million to buy up homes wrecked by that coal ash spill, five and a half million cubic yards of the stuff. And a spill in Maryland threatens to reach Washington, D.C. That's happening even now. Barry writes, it's estimated that somewhere around 30,000 Americans die prematurely each year from the effects of coal dust, untold numbers of kids with asthma attacks, plus you have lost work hours. The Chinese toll is probably 10 times the U.S. numbers. 10% of China's arable land can no longer be used to grow food from all the pollution. Quote, let's all go shopping, end quote. Right, Barry. Yeah, you know, here's the truth. Let's be honest. We can't stop and think about this stuff. We can't, because if we do, we'll go mad. On the other hand, if we don't stop and think about it and solve it, we'll go dead. So the choices are kind of narrow there, aren't they? Yeah, they are. Joette is calling from Madison, Wisconsin, listening on the mic. Hey, Joette.
Hey, Mike, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Love your show.
Thanks.
Thanks for everything that you do, and Kathy. I was listening to your show. I called about a couple things quick. I was listening to Leanne, and I don't think it's up to Obama. I think it's up to us, even though we elected him and hope that he will help us. Mm-hmm. Do what we need to do, not what he needs to do. So I was listening to your show a few weeks ago, and when you were talking about Bob Alexander and prosecutegeorgebush.com and the
yeah.
kickoff for Call Your Prosecutor Day.
Right.
And so I did that, called the prosecutor, and I was talking to Bob this morning for a little while on the phone, because I had some questions before we meet with our Dane County prosecutor. And so after listening to your show, I contacted the Madison Area Peace Coalition and Progressive Dane and the Democrats and the Wisconsin Network for Peace and Justice and have been collecting petitions and kind of wanted to just bring it up again. And I'm wondering if, you know, how other people are doing with it or what's going on in other areas. And just wanted to let you know that thanks for getting that out there and that we're working on it here in Madison.
Yeah, I haven't, I have email and sometimes phone calls with Bob on an irregular basis, but the last time we chatted, he was still waiting for that particular phone call that would tell him that one of these hundreds and hundreds of prosecutors to whom this book was sent, and none of them can plead, I don't know what this is about, because every one of them that had a soldier die in their jurisdiction received this book. So Bob is waiting. I got a little bit worried about how deeply he was going into this. And I mentioned this on the air several months back, you know, that Kierkegaard who talked about peering into the abyss, be careful because eventually the abyss will start peering into you. And it got a little bit scary for me. Bob and his wife Arminda and Jude from Women's Standing in Seattle, a peace organization, how deeply they were going into this. And but they all survived as people like you, like them, who work for peace and justice, always do survive, even though sometimes it starts to have that futile feeling. I was real active in the anti-nuke movement in the 70s, and I know that feeling. So the only thing that I have heard recently from Bob is that he's waiting. And what more can he do? I mean, this guy and the people working with him put everything they had into this with a lot of support from listeners too. I mean, a lot of support from people who heard what he was doing and sent enough money, which always astonishes me that any kind of peace movement is able to, or justice movement is able to raise the funds necessary. You know, the war machine always has plenty of money, but you know, God forbid you should start talking about justice or peace, you know. So I think Bob is waiting. I hope people who have contacted their district attorneys are going ahead with that. We'll just see. And I hope that you do you have a meeting scheduled?
We have a promise of a meeting, and through a friend of our Dane County prosecutor, who's with the Dane County Democrats, and puts out the prosecutor's yard signs and everything, keep getting him elected. So he called in a visit, and I've been so motivated by you, and I was so motivated listening to you talk about what Bob did and the women there in Seattle, and so I decided to do something, and we'll see where it goes. And just, you know, wanted to ask if there are some other listeners out there who are working on it that maybe we could compare notes or.
Yeah, you know. The best way to do this for people who are listening, I think, is to, for the time being, is to get in touch through Bob's website. Come Monday, when we open up MikeMalloy.com, there will be ways for listeners to all over the country to get in touch with each other through our website. For the time being, I think if you go to prosecutegeorgebush.com and stay in touch that way, I think Bob will facilitate that. But come Monday, when what are we going to have, Kathy, that will make it easier for people who listen to this program to be in touch? What are the plans?
You mean like Twitter, Facebook, that kind of thing?
Yeah, or live blogs.
Live blogging. You'll have to just tune in.
But people will be able to coalesce around tonight. Okay. That's the best thing I can come up with now, Joette. So keep doing what you're doing. Don't lose the spirit you obviously have, all right?
Okay, well, thanks for sharing yours. And I did just want to thank you for sharing such a personal story tonight. And I'm sorry what happened.
Yeah, well, you know, stuff happens, and I think everybody has an obligation when stuff happens to figure out a way to get over it. Not through murder or violence. I'm talking about, you know, what Joette's referring to is a little bit I was talking about domestic violence when I was a kid growing up. But you figure out a way, you have to make a decision. And Joette, thanks. I appreciate you checking in. You have to make a decision about that stuff. Are you going to be ground down by it, which is very easy to have happened, or are you going to say no, hell no, and fight? And you know, everybody has that choice, right? Where are we? Bill is calling from Okanagan. Is that right? Washington, Okanagan?
That's right.
Hey, Bill. Listening on XM. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm talking to you over the internet and listening to you over satellite.
Oh my God! Isn't technology wonderful?
It's something. Here's the elephant in the room, as far as I'm concerned, Mike. Somebody needs to ask President Obama a very simple question. In my opinion, somebody needs to stand up and say, President Obama, what is different today in our situation that's going to allow us to prevail in Afghanistan compared to the Soviet Union situation in Afghanistan when they put 500,000 men on the ground and had a border that was contiguous with Afghanistan?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a valid question, right?
Until somebody answers it, we're just being jerked around.
Yeah, I don't know. I know what this president is saying is his rationale for escalating what we're doing in Afghanistan. But and I certainly think Afghanistan, by my standards, by your standards, is chock-a-block with the bad guys. That if justice were universal, we could all say the Taliban needs to be taken out and let them be beaten to death rather than beat to death women and children, especially little girls. But on the other hand, how many lives, American lives, how many soldiers should we commit to this? How much death I guess there was a time in our history we wouldn't consider that. We would say, yeah, it's a noble cause. Let's die for it. I don't know. Once again, Bill, I have no idea. I'm as lost as the next person. Bill, thanks. I appreciate you checking in. We got a break here. We'll be right back. Stay with us. I'm Mike Mullen. Before the hour, thanks to the usual crew, Catherine Bay, who engineered and produced the program and also answered your calls and fixed a batch of fudge today and played with the kid and what else did you do today?
You know, people say it's a joke, but I actually regrouted some tile today.
You did. You regrouted the tile in the kitchen.
I really did.
And tomorrow you're going to put down the silicone.
And I put a filing cabinet together.
You put the filing cabinet.
And we made brownies.
And
it was a rainy day here, so I had a lot of indoor time.
Ben Birch, who didn't do anywhere near that, is our technical advisor. Sharon Gordy, our military affairs correspondent. Bruce Enberg, economic advisor and the ethical advisor of the program. Bob Alexander, Bridget Wolf. So thanks to the whole crew. And don't forget, Monday, MikeMalloy.com. It comes online, the new website. And immediately you will see how you can support this program by subscribing for the podcasts and other items that we are going to be adding as we go along. So we've got a lot of requests about how to get the podcast. Ben's been making them free for the past couple, 3 weeks. Free stops on Monday. So for the podcast, there's always going to be free streaming. And if you listen to XM, Sirius, or on your favorite radio station, that's going to remain the same. But take a look. And we'll see if you're going to be there. And it's going to be considerably less than what it was from the old defunct Nova M in terms of cost. Later on tonight or sometime tomorrow morning, it might be worth your time to go to this website, earthhour.com. EarthHour, H-O-U-R, earthhour.org. I'm sorry, not .com. EarthHour.org, earthhour.org, if you haven't been there already. Very interesting attempt to coordinate global awareness of our poor, sad, tired planet and what it's going through. Check it out, Earth Hour, H-O-U-R, earthhour.org, and see what's up. All right. Who do we have here? Al is calling from Long Beach, California, listening on KTLK. Al, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi, Mike.
Hey.
Yeah, what I was going to say was you got a great show. I'll tell you one thing, you don't pull any punches, and it's really refreshing.
Well, thanks.
And, the thing that I was going to call about is I think I'm going to go along with Obama on this because we're going to have to keep trying. And if it looks that it's impossible, or I'm sure they're smart enough to reverse their stance.
You mean the Afghanistan thing?
Oh, yeah, right. Yeah. And the other thing is, you know, on the opposite side of the coin, if you go back to 1918, when President Wilson killed himself trying to get us to leave the Russians alone, okay, when we went ahead and intervened, and this caused a hornet's nest, which every war since then was caused by that, as far as I'm concerned.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm kind of a historian, so I know what I'm talking about. But anyway, I'm going to go along with Obama on this in the hopes that some sanity might prevail over there.
What would be, once this escalation takes effect, what to you would be a signal that it's not working and we better get our asses out of there?
Well, it's hard to say right away. You know, I think that we're just going to have to play it as it goes. And, you know, when the signals come, you'll know. You'll know when it's time to get out, and I don't think that Obama's...
Well, I'm wondering, the reason I asked that, Al, I'm wondering, there were plenty of signals for the Bush crime family to get out of Iraq,
yeah.
And they didn't. And I'm just wondering, hoping, curious as to whether or not if those signs and portents show themselves, will Barack Obama and his administration... have the courage to do what very few American presidents have ever done.
But what it is, it's motive. A motive in Iraq, I think, is quite different, okay? In Iraq, as you know, the oil situation being what it was, number one, the residual effects of the Cold War, okay? That was another big factor. That's what it was all about, the residual effects of the Cold War. Saddam Hussein was not supposed to go into Kuwait. He was told by Russia not to do it because Russia was backing off the Cold War. And one thing led to another. But the motive in Afghanistan, I don't think it's oil. Do you?
Well, it started out, it was a pipeline. Don't forget, at one time, the Taliban leadership went to Houston, Texas, to sit down and talk with our people about building a pipeline across Afghanistan to get all that natural gas and oil out of the Caspian Sea area. And they said, nah, we don't think so. And they were told, according to the book that I read several years ago, written by the French journalist and the French intelligence operative, the Taliban was told, either go along with this, we'll pave your streets with gold, or we'll pave your streets with bomb craters. It's your choice.
Who told them that we'd pave it with bomb craters?
The people speaking for the oil industry at the meeting in Houston, Texas.
Well, you know, that could, you know, this is a lot of intrigue in another scenario, okay? But I don't really see the Taliban involved in that. I mean, of course, I know there's a big factor. There's always that greed factor and that, you know, behind the scenes.
Well, it is greed, but it's also empire, and it's also containment of China, which is our next adversary. Hey, listen, I got to leave it there. Thanks. Thanks, Al. I appreciate you checking in. If we didn't get to your call tonight, I apologize. But it's time to go. Have a great weekend, okay? I'll see you Monday night. Don't forget, MikeMalloy.com. Check it out Monday. Take care. Keep it lit. I'm Mike Malloy. Have a great weekend, Kevin, Kenny, wherever you are.
Going straight to hell, just like my mama said.